From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moskowain. On this edition of Fresh Air, a firsthand account of life inside Leavenworth. Journalist Pete Early tells us about the 2 years he spent visiting Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary and talking with the inmates and the men who keep them behind bars. Also today, we examine the emotional aftermath of violence. It's the subject of Richard Bausch's new novel called Violence. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new book that unearths a treasure of controversy surrounding the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Campaigners for former Massachusetts Senator Paul Saugus moved quickly today to dispel any impression left by last night's Democratic presidential debate that Saugus is weak on the environment. Saugus's support of the nuclear power industry drew criticism from other candidates. NPR's Caroline Clark reports from Manchester.
During a rally in Portsmouth, Paul Saugus reminded supporters that he had opposed building the controversial Seabrook nuclear power plant and had a long record in the Senate of supporting solar energy. He said he was angered to hear the other candidates question his environmental credentials.
I want to make it clear, there's one avid environmentalist in this race, and you're looking at him.
A former state legislator and environmental activist, Dudley Dudley, told the crowd that Saugus has the best environmental record of all the candidates. And though she differs with Saugus on his support for nuclear power as a last resort energy alternative, she believes as president, he would see that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulates the industry rather than promoting it. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Manchester.
Tens of thousands of people in the suburbs of Beirut today participated in the funeral of Hezbollah leader Sheikh Abbas Mousawi. Mousawi, his wife and son were killed yesterday in an Israeli rocket attack on a convoy in which they were traveling. Jim Muir filed this report for the BBC from Lebanon.
Hezbollah! There were tumultuous and emotional scenes as the coffins holding the remains of Sheikh Abbas Mousawi, his wife and young son, were brought out of the mosque on the main road to Beirut Airport. Tens of thousands of Hezbollah supporters had turned out to pay their last respects to their slain leader. They chanted angry Islamic slogans, death to America, death to Israel, war until victory. Before being taken across the mountains for burial in Sheikh Abbas's birthplace in the Bekaa Valley, the coffins were borne in a vast procession into the heart of the southern suburbs, where Hezbollah has a strong following. There they were laid side by side in a square while speeches were made and prayers said for the man whose followers now acclaim him as the latest and greatest of the many martyrs they have given in their struggle to oust the Israelis from the south of the country.
Jim Muir in Beirut. Argentine intelligence files made public today say that fugitive Nazi Joseph Mengele, responsible for killing 400,000 Jews, kept a mistress in Paraguay. The woman is alleged to be an Israeli agent and a survivor of a Nazi concentration camp. She was known as Nurit Edat, and she died either in an accident or was murdered. The Israeli embassy said it had no information on her or her manner of death. Mengele was convicted in 1959 in Frankfurt of war crimes for his role in the death camps. The Russian team of Marina Klimova and her husband Sergei Ponomarenko skated past the French team of Isabel and Paul Duchesne to take the gold in ice dancing today. This is NPR. The Los Angeles Times reports that the main parties in many civil lawsuits lodged against jailed junk bond financier Michael Milken have reached a tentative agreement to settle. The deal is reportedly worth $1.3 billion. The huge settlement still needs approval from some parties involved in the litigation. The Times quoted sources who said there were still several obstacles to be hurdled. A preliminary exam into murder charges filed against Dr. Jack Kevorkian concluded today in Michigan. The judge will issue his ruling later this month as to whether Kevorkian will go on trial for assisting in two suicides. Don Gagne reports.
Kevorkian has been charged with open murder in the deaths of 43-year-old Sherry Miller and 58-year-old Marjorie Wants, who took their own lives in a campground north of Detroit using devices and drugs provided by the doctor. Defense attorneys maintain that Michigan has no law forbidding a doctor from assisting in a suicide, but the prosecution cites a 1920 case heard by the state Supreme Court in which a man was convicted of murder for supplying his sick wife with poison, which she then drank. Judge James Sheehy will decide if that case is applicable here. He will issue his decision on February 28th. His options are to dismiss the charges or to proceed with a murder trial. A year ago, in a separate but similar case involving a Kevorkian-assisted suicide, murder charges against the doctor were dismissed. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer was sentenced to life in prison today. Dahmer told the judge that he took all the blame for what he did. Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Lawrence Graham sentenced Dahmer to 15 consecutive life terms, effectively preventing him from ever becoming eligible for parole. Dahmer said that he really wished he could be put to death for the Holocaust that he created by killing and dismembering 15 young men and boys. A jury decided Saturday that Dahmer was sane when he committed the murders. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Leavenworth Prison in Kansas is the nation's oldest federal penitentiary. And though it's one of the most dangerous maximum security prisons, the cells are open until 10 o'clock at night. The inmates can walk around freely, which is why my guest, journalist Pete Early, chose it as the subject of his book on life behind bars, The Hothouse. Early spent 2 years as the only journalist ever allowed unlimited access to Leavenworth. But to gain that access, Early had to agree that prison had no responsibility for his safety. Once inside, Early was faced with having to establish trust with the prisoners while protecting himself from them at the same time.
Most of the officers there either wear a body alarm or a two-way radio. There are no weapons because it would be too dangerous. A convict might take a weapon away from you. And I was offered a body alarm or a radio, but I decided not to wear one because I didn't want to look like the staff. I wanted to try to keep that impartial feeling in the atmosphere. So I stayed with the guards the first time I went in for about 3 weeks, and then I finally ventured out into the yard. One of the things you realize in prison is that both the guards and the staff test each other. And I was tested. When I was out in the yard for the first time alone, I was surrounded by about 400 convicts in the yard. And one of them came up to me and they said, "Do you know who that inmate over there is?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, you should find out. He kills reporters." And later found out it was Bruce Pierce from The Order, the fellow who machine-gunned Alan Berg, the Denver talk show host. Now, I never ran into Mr. Pierce, but that didn't matter. What they were doing, the inmates around me, were going to see how I reacted, because convicts have a special sense of fear, and whenever they feel fear, then they can prey on people.
You said at Leavenworth that the cells were open from 6:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. What did these inmates do all day long?
Well, again, about 80% of them simply went to work. The Bureau requires most of them to have jobs. And then they'd get off before the 4 o'clock count, which is the important prison count. Everyone has to stand up in his cell and be counted. And then they'd go to recreation, or they'd go to college classes, or they'd go lift weights. The Bureau has a number of programs to keep them entertained. And the institution itself, if you were to walk in, is not a hellhole. It's a spit shine, and it looks very nice, and they have all these programs, and they feed the inmates very well. The reason it's such a terrible place is because of the other 20% of inmates. Those are the predators, and they try to do the same thing inside Leavenworth they did on the street, run drugs, booze, card games, prostitutes, and pull cons on each other. The difference is they have to be much more clever because the people they are tricking are other convicts who will kill them.
What would spark a fight?
Just about anything. One day I was talking to an inmate in his cell, and the music of Hank Williams Jr. started blaring in the cell next to us. And this man said, "Excuse me." He stood up. He went and got a shank, which is a prison knife, and he tucked it in his pants. He walked over to the cell and said, "Your music's too loud. You're disrespecting me." Now, luckily, that inmate turned it down. The inmate came back, and he told me. I said, "Gee, would you have attacked that guy over something like this?" And he said, "Of course, because that's disrespect." And I said, "What would you have done?" And he said, "I would have run the gears," which is prison slang for saying the best way to kill someone is to jab a knife into him and then pull it up and over and down and over, just like if you were changing gears in your car.
You said a shank. Now, a prison knife, is this something that the inmates make, they fashion out of something else?
Right. And they're very ingenious about this. Convicts are not stupid people. They're very ingenious about the kind of things they need to do to survive. For example, most common shanks are made out of any kind of metal, a piece of metal broken off a chair. Then you put cleansing powder on the floor and just simply scrape a point on it. But I saw perhaps the most clever shank I saw was a guy who was in total isolation. And the only thing that was brought to him was a styrofoam lunch or breakfast or dinner covered by a sheet of clear plastic. He saved the plastic every day for a month, rolled it up as tight as he could until it was a long pencil shape, heated it with a match, and had a plastic shank with a point on it, and tried to put a guard's eye out with it.
Does everyone have a shank inside of Leavenworth?
Well, it's impossible to tell how many there are. They usually find, two or three a week. These are things that people don't usually keep in their cells. And it depends on what the climate is. When things get bad and the inmates know it, then you'll see guys actually wrapping themselves in magazines, taping them to their chest under their shirts to use as body armor, and then they'll start what they call strapping, which means carrying shanks.
My guest is Pete Early, and he's the author of a book on Leavenworth Prison called The Hot House. You had said earlier that the guards are not armed. How do they maintain order?
Well, they do it through a number of ways, psychological and also physical. The most immediate way is, if you're in trouble and you're an officer, you punch your body alarm, which emits a loud squealing signal. Then every other officer who is not in a tower or manning a gate is supposed to run immediately to that area. And the idea is you'll have 30 or 40 guards running up on a situation, and that will scare the person off. Of course, what the Bureau's also discovered is if there's ever a riot situation, that's one good way to take hostages. Another psychological message that is sent is what's called standing main line. Every day when they have the feeding in the mess hall and they have 400, 500, 600 inmates in there, all of the prison top officials from the warden down come and stand in front of the group. Now, during that time, any inmate can go up and ask a question or talk to them or anything else, and that's technically the reason they're there. But there's also a message being sent. We're not afraid of you. We don't have weapons, and you outnumber us 20-1, but we'll stand right here while you eat lunch because we're in charge.
How would you then describe the relationship between the inmate and the guard? And you talk about the kind of power relationships going on inside of Leavenworth Prison.
Well, it's one of dehumanization on both levels. I was shocked when I found out that most officers had no idea what the men they were guarding had done, what kind of crimes they had committed. And later I found out this was intentional. Perhaps a captain put it to me best. He said one day an inmate came to him and said, gee, this guy down the hall is going to rape me. You've got to protect me. You've got to do something. And it was a guy who was about 26 years old, and he was actually in tears. So the captain said, just a minute, and he went and pulled the file, and he found out that this guy had kidnapped two children in Michigan, small boys, 3 and 5, taken them to a mountain, sexually abused them, lit them on fire, and eventually killed them. And he said, you know, before he knew what that fellow had done, he had some sympathy for him. But then he thought, geez, you know, look at what kind of creature this is. And yet he struggled with it in his mind, and he finally came back and he said, I finally decided the reason we treat these people the way we do, we treat them with respect, we treat them well, is not because of what they've done, but because of who we are as individuals. And that was how he dealt with that. But both sides dehumanize the other. Both of them do not like to know that much about the crimes. The inmates, for instance, try to know very little about the guards. And if the two sides start to get in a situation where a guard and inmate get friendly, both sides start pressuring that person to back off.
You interviewed one of the guards, and he said, I can be violent, just as violent as any inmate in here, if the situation demands that. I can even kill. I've killed many men, but I am not a predator. And that's what separates us from them. We don't cross that line. Was that true with all the guards, would you say?
Well, I should explain that that guard had killed people when he was in the military in Vietnam, and that was why he said he'd killed very many men. To be a guard, you had to be very tough and also resilient. These are guys who have feces and urine thrown at them regularly. They're guys who are threatened, and the inmates try to intimidate them. And again, it's interesting, about 80% of the guard force handled that, were extremely professional. You didn't have any trouble with them. And then there was always about 20%, which mirrored the image of the convicts and the predators. And these guys were constantly getting in trouble, and the Bureau was trying to weed them out. The problem is this. You can have all the PhDs and masters, and you'd be surprised how many Correctional officers have college degrees and advanced degrees. But you can have all those you want. You can talk all you want. But when it comes down to it and you have a guy standing in his cell and he has a shank and he's covered himself with his own feces and he's thrown soap on the floor and he's yelling profanity at you and he wants to kill someone, you have to have somebody who's just as big of a brute and just as big of a beast who's not afraid to go in there and take care of the job. And that's why you always have a level of guards that are accused of brutality, et cetera.
Tell us about the pecking order within the prison. Who maintains this control, this 20% that you talked about who are not cowed by imprisonment? How do they maintain control? How do they prove themselves?
Well, the inmates divide into various gangs, cliques, and groups. It's a totally racist environment. The largest percentage of black inmates in the institution come from Washington, D.C., and they're known as D.C. Blacks. And they all were run basically by one person, which was interesting because he really kept control over the whole group. Now, the other groups did not have one strong leader. You had the mafia, which stayed by themselves. Then you had the White Aryan Brotherhood. That only consisted of a couple of fellows. And the rest of them, maybe 20 or 30, were wannabes, people who wanted to join and become part of this AB gang, and they served them. And then you had just various cliques within the group, and then you had this couple, only a few, lone wolves. And most of these folks, you'd had splinter gangs, the Georgia Boys, it was regional, et cetera, et cetera. But most of the inmates there would identify with the area they came from or with people they knew. Because you have to remember, everyone always talks about going into prison and hearing the bars slam behind them. That affects convicts, too. They're just as afraid when they enter an institution as anyone else.
And how did inmates use sex as a way of maintaining power?
Well, what I discovered was that what you see is any kind of weakness will lead to people taking advantage of you. One of the fellows who I interviewed who'd been in for 23 years said the only way you survive in here is making it clear that if anyone wants to take something from you, whether it be your commissary or have sex with you, you have to make it more painful for them than they will make it to you, and therefore they'll let up. What I discovered, though, when it came to inmate rapes, perhaps the inmate who I discussed this with described it best. He said he had been raped when he was in prison. Three guys attacked him when he was 16 and raped him. And he later got out, and he remembered the pain and anger and humiliation. And then he got in trouble in Arizona, and he was thrown in a jail cell with a 17-year-old. And he raped him. He beat him up, and he raped him. And he said while he was doing that, he remembered that humiliation, and he felt bad about it. But it was just this great sense of power that he had. And how when you're at the bottom of the heap, and everybody else tells you what to do, and everybody else can dump on you, all of a sudden you have someone you have complete power over. And he described it like a piece of meat. I can do anything I want to this person. Now, I heard the same kind of comments in killers who had described shooting their victims and watching them, you know, crawl towards a phone and letting them almost get there and then shooting them again. It's almost like this godlike power over someone else. And I discovered the rapes had very little to do with sex as much as it did with just being able to humiliate another human being, because these fellows felt that they were being humiliated in the system.
How much consensual sex was going on, would you say, inside of Leavenworth?
Well, I think, that's very hard to judge because this was something that was very difficult for inmates to talk about, but I think there was an awful lot of it. Again, one of the inmates I spent a lot of time with me said that you really don't have to rape anyone. There are a lot of services provided. There were a lot of prostitutes who were willing to trade a carton of cigarettes for sex. The problem that most of the inmates had with that was that if you took someone, if you raped someone or you took power over someone and made them your punk, then that showed a certain amount of power or class as opposed to someone who is running to a prostitute. I mean, the outlaws aren't supposed to have to buy sex. Also, the convicts feel very strongly that the Bureau encourages homosexuality because that psychologically makes you feel less of a man. If you're heterosexual and you're forced into a homosexual relationship, you feel like you are less of a person. And the convicts who consider themselves hardcore convicts really detest the fact that there aren't conjugal visits, because if they cross that line, they see themselves as being weak. And the first step to being weak is to have someone take advantage of you, and then you become a rat, et cetera, et cetera.
My guest today is Pete Early, and he was the first journalist allowed free access inside of Leavenworth Prison. He did his research with no promises of protection. He spent 2 years on and off in the prison researching his book called The Hothouse. And we're going to talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Pete Early. You write that inmates rarely had trouble finding women to visit them or to correspond with, and a fair number of these relationships turned into marriage. Were you able to understand the attraction that a woman would have with a man who was, we'll say, sentenced to life in prison or 25 years in prison?
Well, one thing is that convicts, by their nature, understand people. They look for weaknesses just like a psychiatrist would, but then instead of trying to help someone, they take advantage of them. And these guys would write letters and put ads in papers, and they would get a tremendous response. Two or three or four women would start writing them. And the thing convicts have is a lot of time. So they would write long, long letters, you know, 20, 30 pages, passionate letters to these women and get them to come visit them. And the third Thursday of every month was reserved for weddings, and there were always weddings, even guys who were in forever. And a lot of the women fit the stereotype, low self-esteem, et cetera. I found it interesting when I talked to them about their explanations of why they came. Some of them were kind of frivolous. One woman said, well, at least I know where he is at night. But another woman told me about the time that she had married this guy, and she knew he was a bank robber. He'd been in prison, and then he went back in prison, and she went to visit him. And while she was waiting in the visiting room, another inmate walked by and made a crass comment about her figure. And she never said anything, but other inmates told her husband. And so that week, he broke the guy's arms and beat him up. And the next week, he came into the visiting room and told her about it. And she was thrilled because she said, gee, nobody ever cared enough about me to do something like that.
Did you ask yourself, when you were working, investigating and reporting inside of Leavenworth, how you would have survived if you had been an inmate there?
Did that come up? Well, you wonder that, because I think anybody who goes in immediately puts yourself in that situation, which is dangerous because you tend to put your feelings onto an inmate. I'll give you an example. When I met Tommy Silverstein, who is kept in this basement cell, he killed a guard, stabbed him 57 times, and so the Bureau has put him in the basement of Leavenworth in a steel cell that has two lines of bars in front of it. It's kind of like Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. And this place is so isolated, you can't even hear toilets flushing. All you hear is the buzz of the fluorescent lights. And the lights are kept on 24 hours a day. And he's been like this since 1983. And when I first saw him, I felt a tremendous amount of empathy because, my Lord, this guy sleeps with the lights on and everything. And it really bothered me, and I kept mentioning the lights. And then he finally said, gee, you know, I never even thought about those lights. I just close my eyes and go to sleep. So you got to watch, you know, putting yourself in. But to answer your question, which I was avoiding there, you do think about it. And I don't know how I would have survived because the bottom line is you're going to be preyed on unless you're willing to kill someone. And so you get these strange things that happen in prison. One day, a white and a black inmate got into an argument, believe it or not, over whether to watch Jeopardy or watch Vanna White on Wheel of Fortune. And the black inmate was very good with his fist, and he pretty well embarrassed the white inmate. That night, a number of whites came to him and said, you've embarrassed the entire race. You have to take action. So the next day in the mess hall, this guy approached the black from behind, threw a towel off of his hand, and he had a 17-inch shank there, and he thrust it into the black man's back, trying to sever his spinal cord. Now, when I interviewed that guy, he was very keen on having me know he hadn't tried to kill him. He said, look, if I wanted to kill that guy, I would have jumped him in a stairway and I would have stabbed him 30 or 40 times. That was to save face. All I did was hit him to show everybody I wasn't a coward. But I don't want a life sentence over this. Please make sure everybody knows I was just doing that to save face. I had no choice.
Now, an experience like that, does that make you feel any more or less vulnerable when you're outside, when you're out on the streets?
Yeah, you get extremely paranoid. And you also get, what happens is you get sucked into the darkness of Leavenworth, and the guards face this all the time, too. My reaction to that stabbing, I'd been in a long time when it happened, and my reaction was one of disappointment that the guy hadn't died. And I know that sounds very sick, but at that point in the institution, everyone was so, it gets so compressed that you want to release. And you'll hear guards talking about a good stabbing because for days after that, everybody talks about it and you feel like, phew, at least it wasn't me. And the other thing I discovered is when you come out, that paranoia stays with you. One of the things the convicts told me was the first thing they do when they get out is they get a gun. And I thought, well, of course you get a gun. You use it in the crime. And they said, no. If you've been in Leavenworth and you see what people are really capable of doing and how evil they can be, you want to protect yourself. These guys are more scared than the rest of us when they're on the street.
Do you still have contact with any of the inmates that you interviewed?
Yeah, Silverstein called me last week. He's allowed a 15-minute phone call every month, and he called me, and there are about two or three of them that I correspond with regularly. Usually a journalist goes through a period where after a book comes out, it cuts off that association and moves on. It's part of pulling away from the project, getting yourself out of it. In this case, I think I would like to continue writing to some of those men simply because, as strange as it may sound, we kind of shared this experience. It's weird in the sense of when you're in a place like Leavenworth, everything seems more intense because your adrenaline's pumping, because you know you could be injured. And that intenseness kind of brings about a friendship with both the inmates and the guards that seems much stronger than when you're on this street.
What did you and Tommy Silverstein talk about?
Well, almost all of Silverstein's letters are about how much he hates the guard and how much he's being abused and how terrible the system is, because that's his entire world. You also have to realize the way you survive in a prison when you're someone like Silverstein who's been taken, everything taken away. In 1983, after he killed a guard, for 6 months, he sat in a cell with nothing but his boxer shorts. For 6 solid months, no one to talk to. The way you survive by that is through hate and through your own pride. I'm not going to commit suicide because I'm not going to give these guys the satisfaction. And then you develop what they call beating the man. Throw Kellogg's cornflakes in your toilet bowl and let them sit there for a week, and you'll get a drink that you can get intoxicated on. You know, take the plastic off your meal and make a knife. You've just beaten the man. And so this game comes up of how you beat the man, and that's what keeps you going. And so you focus on that interior world. One of the things you discover in a place like Leavenworth is once you're in there, you forget about what the outside world is like. You even start to dream that you're in prison. And one of the scariest episodes I had, I was talking to a fellow who was a bank robber, and he said, you know, when I first came in here, I used to dream about having sex with my wife. Now I dream about raping a guard. And he said, in my dream, it's all black and white. And then I pull down this guy's pants and I start to rape him. And all of a sudden a knife appears and I'm stabbing him in the back and the dream goes to Technicolor. And I keep having this dream. And then he turned and he looked at me and he said, Pete, I wonder what I'll be dreaming in 2 years when I get out.
Mm-hmm. What do you dream about?
Well, I have had a few dreams about Leavenworth, but luckily I'm getting out of that. You know, authors don't have time to dream. We're up at night working or too nervous about the next book.
Well, Pete Early, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pete Early's book about Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary is called The Hot House. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Violence, it seems, is inescapable. We see it on TV, read about it in the papers, and yes, hear about it on the radio. Coming up, Richard Bausch talks about violence and how it inspired his new novel of the same name. Also, if you're in the mood for a scandal, book critic John Leonard has an unlikely suggestion for you, The Dead Sea Scrolls Deception. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Presidential hopefuls traveled across the state of New Hampshire today in their last efforts before tomorrow's primary. A good showing is vital to some campaigns as to whether they continue or not. On the Republican side, while President Bush took part in radio interviews from the White House, challenger Patrick Buchanan made his final tour of the Granite State. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from Manchester.
The scene was one being repeated across New Hampshire as throngs of reporters try to get close to the major presidential candidates. Patrick Buchanan arrived at a diner in Concord, pushed his way inside, couldn't get close to voters because of all the press, and went back to his bus. Outside, members of a Jewish group denounced Buchanan for his support of alleged Nazi war criminals, Rabbi Avram Weiss.
If in fact it is correct, as I believe it is correct, that he is an anti-Semite, and that he's a defender of Nazis, then that should disqualify him.
Buchanan has repeatedly denounced charges of anti-Semitism in the past, although today he stayed away from the issue.
This campaign is about the United States of America, my friend.
Buchanan is expected to capture more than 20% of the Republican vote from President Bush tomorrow. I'm Andy Bowers in Manchester.
On the Democratic side, late polls show that Paul Tsongas is in the lead in New Hampshire. In Algeria, riot police in the capital have broken up a demonstration by Islamic fundamentalists. The students were protesting the cancellation of the country's general elections after the Islamic Salvation Front appeared ready to win a veto-proof majority in parliament. Jackie Rowland reports from Algiers.
Universities across Algeria have been hit by a wave of fundamentalist demonstrations. Hundreds of students have marched around campuses, chanting Islamic slogans and waving copies of the Quran. In several universities, lectures have been cancelled and examinations postponed. The students are complaining about the state of emergency imposed last week and about the arrest of some of their lecturers. Thousands of people have been arrested over the past week, and five detention centres have been set up in the Sahara to house them. The Algerian Human Rights League has complained about how the arrests have been carried out. There are reports that security forces ransacked houses before arresting people. The Human Rights League has called on the authorities to tell the families of detainees where their relatives are being held. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Algiers.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Secretary of State Baker say that they made some progress in talks in Moscow on separate proposals for more cuts in nuclear weapons. However, no additional agreements have been reached. Yeltsin said that while the two sides were very close to each other, in talks on arms control, there are still what he termed minor differences. He said that he hoped agreements on arms cuts can be signed at a planned July summit with President Bush. This is NPR News. Two U.S. senators say that they have been given information by the Russian government that U.S. deserters were in the Soviet Union after the Vietnam War, and possibly some POWs were taken there. Senator John Kerry and Senator Robert Smith say that there is no evidence, however, that any U.S. serviceman stayed in the country. At a news conference in Moscow, Kerry said that they had been told that a number of deserters from Vietnam were contacted in Japan, passed through the Soviet Union, and then left. Smith said the Russian government agreed to send a diplomat to Vietnam and Laos to press those countries to provide new information on American servicemen from the Vietnam War. Convicted serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer was sentenced to life in prison today for the murders of 15 young men and boys in Milwaukee. Beth Graham of member station WUWM has more.
Milwaukee County Judge Lawrence Graham sentenced Dahmer to 15 consecutive life sentences, making it impossible for the convicted serial killer to ever walk freely again. And for the first time since his arrest last July, Dahmer spoke publicly of his remorse for the victim's relatives.
I know how much harm I have caused. I tried to do the best I could after the arrest to make amends, but no matter what I did, I could not undo the terrible harm I have caused.
Dahmer is expected to serve his sentence at Wisconsin's Columbia Correctional Institution, a maximum security prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Graham in Milwaukee.
Officials in Chile say that former East German leader Erich Honecker is very ill and should be hospitalized. Honecker has been inside Chile's embassy in Moscow for over 2 months and is said to be suffering from cancer. Honecker escaped to the Soviet Union after German unification and is now wanted by German officials. He reportedly refuses hospitalization. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In his latest novel, Violence, Richard Bausch explores what happens to someone in the aftermath of a violent confrontation. Charles and Carol Connolly are a young couple expecting their first child. During a trip to Chicago, Charles goes to a late-night convenience store and walks in on an armed robbery that turns brutal and bloody when four people are killed. Charles survives along with the owner of the store. Violence is Richard Bausch's fifth novel. He's also written two books of short stories. His twin brother, Robert Bausch, is a novelist as well. Susan Kenney, reviewing Violence for the New York Times, called the novel a masterly exploration of the public and private manifestations of violence. She went on to praise Bausch for his grace of language and detail that goes beyond mere witnessing, straight to the heart. For Charles Connolly, this violent incident is a trigger to his past that leaves him baffled and disturbed by what he remembers.
In Charles's case, I think it just, the idea of violence becomes, it occurs to him quite, it seems, quite casually. He's sitting in a park and he thinks, what if someone came to the park and harmed this woman, which is a perfectly, in fact, a perfectly rational and explicable thought given what he's been through, but the thought scares him. And it's the fact that the thought scares him that begins to unlock the stuff that's going on inside, the buried memory of violence. And then he begins to fear violence in himself. It seems possible that he would be the agency by which the violence would happen because it occurs to him in the park.
And he imagines hurting his family.
Right. It begins to come to it. He becomes afraid that he might hurt his family. And this fear, I want the reader to know quite well that Charles isn't going to hurt anybody. That it's a subjective kind of walking, as Richard Ford put it, a kind of walking pneumonia-like insanity that he's in, and that it's a thing he has to go through to get back to the root, to the things that happened when he was smaller, where he had not only, you know, people talk about an abusive father, but it wasn't only an abusive father. It was being shuffled from house to house and being in different neighbors' houses and relatives' houses and never really having a sense of a family. And here his wife is about to start one. And, you know, in the abstract and intellectually, he wants a family. But the idea, when it is presented to him in reality, is quite frightening because he's never had it himself. He really doesn't even know what it is.
Do you keep up on psychological issues, or have you been in therapy? Because you write, it seems like, with a kind of intuitive understanding about families and the psychology or the feelings in families.
No, I've never been. I would be afraid to go into therapy. I was afraid they'd probably say, we'll just stay right here. We're going to go to a jacket. I think that you, but I've read all of, so much of the world's great literature, and I'm not bragging now. I'm reporting on an obsession that from the time I was, 16 or 17, I couldn't get enough of it. There was a certain kind of nourishment provided by this stuff that I couldn't get anywhere else in the world. And I wanted to know everything that was ever written or said that was worth remembering. I wanted it to do that to me again, every time, the way it did it to me the first time I read, the first time I read Fitzgerald. I've read The Great Gatsby maybe 500 times.
Really?
I read the book every year for the last 22 years, and sometimes two or three years at a time, And I know I read it a lot more when I was in the Air Force, so. But I think that the insight that you get is given to you, and the subconscious is what gives it to you.
Mm-hmm. You said that you read a lot, and I assume you still do. When did you actually start to write?
I was about 17 or 18 years old, and I got this white quill pen, and I really just went, whole hog, got a little desk. And my parents were always so blithe about it. It was like whatever I wanted to do, I would be able to do it. I mean, I remember once when I was 11 years old saying to my father, I want to be an artist because I could always draw. Huh. Or heavyweight champion of the world. I think my father went into this, tired. Oh, no, the boxing is so corrupt. And the fighters are all, they never see the money and these corrupt promoters and everything. And at the time, I was a little ticked at him for, discouraging me. But he wasn't just, what a gift that was. I mean, here I was 11 years old and a grown-up was taking me utterly seriously. That if I wanted to be heavyweight champion, by God, that's what I'd do, and so I better be warned. And it was sort of like that. I mean, that whatever I wanted to tackle. So immediately there was all this encouragement, a typewriter and everything. I think I wrote the first story I ever wrote when I was 14, and my mother read it and said, "This is very good, but it's so morbid, son. How come it's so morbid?"
Well, you were 14, right?
Yeah. Well, everything I've written since then has been pretty much, according to most reports I get from the critics, morbid, but I don't think it's morbid. I think it's redemptive, and it's just about all of the trouble we live with. I can't believe that anyone could want to read fiction that wasn't about trouble. I mean, what the hell? It's like wanting to see a football game with no tackling. I mean, it's sort of a part of it. It's like, who wants to read a book called How Wonderful We Were and How Happy We Were and What We Ate? It would just bore me to death, so...
But what made you think that you could be a writer? I mean, obviously you thought you could be a boxer, too.
I certainly wouldn't have done very well at that. There's an old line Hemingway used about when he was younger. It says, you suspicioned that you were going to be pretty good. And I think part of it is just the sense of that I could ape the sound of what I was reading. I could sound like Walt Whitman's Song of Myself without actually copying the poem. I could sound like it. And then gradually, people start saying, you really ought to do this. You've got,
Did you have teachers that encouraged you?
Teachers, yes, mm-hmm. and family and stuff like that. And Bob, my brother, wrote a novel when he was in the eighth grade, so it was sort of planted. It was called Hidden Glory. It was a Civil War book that he was illustrating, and whole family was all excited about it. My sister was typing up chapters for him and stuff. And
this is your twin brother,
yeah,
Robert.
Yeah. So, it's a thing. And, of course, my father and mother, everybody in the family tells stories. I mean, we grew up listening to all those stories. I never had any doubt about what a story was or how to tell a story. Regarding the art of writing short stories, that was a thing I had to teach myself and learned from the great writers. But never had any doubt about characters and, people moving through stories.
Richard Bausch is a novelist. His latest book is called Violence. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Richard Bausch is my guest. He's a writer and has written 5 novels now and 2 books of short stories. His latest novel is called Violence. There was a time, though, you wanted to be a musician,
yeah,
or a rock musician.
Yeah.
What happened to that?
I reached the end of the possibilities in the key of G and realized that I wasn't going to get much further than that. And now I have a son who's playing, you know, Jimi Hendrix and wants me to play guitar with him. And it's kind of funny because, you know, I'm so far behind him. It's like, you know, okay, Dad, now we're going to count 1, 2, 3. There we go, Dad. Shift keys, Dad. And I feel real bad for him trying to hold himself back for me, but he loves to play, so.
But wasn't it Bob Dylan, though, that was your, I mean, like all of us back then, the person that you wanted to fashion yourself after?
I was going to be another Bob Dylan or another Paul Simon. You know, I was going to write songs that had meaning and, you know, poem songs. I still have a song called Harlem that I think is a pretty damn good song, and other songs that are sort of echoes of Joni Mitchell and other songwriters that I like, and I still occasionally write a song, but the melodies are real dull and not very interesting. And, you know, maybe out of the hundreds of songs I tried, there's probably 4 of them that I remember that are worth anything.
Yeah.
In the sense that somebody might sing them and they'd be, at least you wouldn't say, oh, that's terrible.
Do you write with music playing?
Uh-huh, usually. Especially when I'm composing, I like to have. The Mozart quintet, you know, the clarinet quintet is beautiful to write to. And there's others. I even write to some sweeping, big, heavy symphonies, but then you tend to really make flourishes there. You know, toward the end of the Resurrection Symphony, all of a sudden the cadences get pretty heroic, and, you know, you're supposed to be in a store buying a loaf of bread, and it doesn't really...
But you don't use Jimi Hendrix then as a backdrop?
No, I can't.
Yeah.
Rock and roll.
No,
I can't. My kids want to study to rock and roll, and they'd say, well, you work right listening to music. I say, well, it's different. Classical music is different. It's a music that you can hear with your subconscious. Yeah. It's amazing to me how well I know a piece of music after I've written to it and then go hear it played and I know what's coming, even though I have not consciously sat there and listened to it. It's just in the background.
Well, let me ask you a practical question, because as much as writing is, you know, a wonderful, lofty career goal to have, it's hard to make a living. And it seems that most of your books have been published in the last 10 or 12 years. What about the lean times? How did you survive that?
Karen and I survived it. There were times when it was pretty tough, but having come through it, we both feel that it was worth it. But, I mean, we had some tough times, some very tough times.
You're talking tough financially?
All
tough
of it.
In all
whole
ways?
Way, every way.
Did you think of, I can't do this? I can't be a writer anymore?
I would talk about it. Karen would say, what are you going to do, change your nature? I mean, at one point I was offered a job. And I like to tell this story. I sat down and Karen lined up all the things that would come with that job, security and all the rest, and then listed the one disadvantage, that I'd hate it, and I'd come home at night hating myself. And so we said no to this job that would have meant security and went through another year of real trouble. I mean, creditors banging on the door.
Really?
And that kind of thing, yeah.
How do you write under that kind of pressure?
Oh, that's when you really write. You write like crazy then. It's a hell of a lot easier to write then than it is when your people are, you know, calling you to tell you how great everything is and how much they like your work and stuff. Then it becomes hard because, well, I'm good. You know, I'll wait until tomorrow. I can do this in a week.
Get lazy?
It's easy to get lazy. You have to really watch out for it. Mm-hmm. One of the ways I fight it is just to be disciplined about it and exclude it, not read the reviews, that kind of stuff. This is too hard a thing to do without everything you got.
And I guess reviews are kind of like taking your temperature all the time, or sort of, you know, see, how am I doing?
Yeah, you know. And I don't go into bookstores much now.
Yeah.
You know,
Your book or something.
Yeah, and maybe it's not there, and then I have 3 days of depression about that. You know? There's no sense worrying about that stuff. The thing is to get it written. Keats said, remember me as one whose name was written in water. You know, and you have to accept that as a part of your destiny, or else you're really doomed.
You've said, I don't know if it's still true, that short stories were your first love, and you described them as recreation, and novels you saw as commitment. I could see how they both would be love, But very different, of course.
Yeah. Novels are, they come out of obsession. Short stories come out of whimsy.
Hmm.
And although a lot of obsession gets in them before it's all over with, but for me, a short story is like, well, I'm going to write a story, yeah. And it may take me 6 months to do it, but it's just that, you know, a novel, which may take 4 months, is just an entire commitment to a whole universe that you're going to have to do a lot of homework, you know, the whole thing. It's tough.
Well, how do you know you're going to set out to do a short story versus a novel?
In fact, I don't always know. I thought Violence was a short story. And realized about 10 or 12 pages in that it was a novel. I came home and told Karen, I really am going to write a novel called Violence. I mean, I thought I was going to do this short story. And she said, you know, well, great. We need the money. You know, we make a lot more money with novels than short stories.
Do you think it's any accident that both you and your brother are writers and you're twins?
Mm-mm. No. It feels like what we should be doing. It feels as inevitable as anything. I mean, it feels as inevitable as the fact that we're both past 40 now.
Mm-hmm. But do you help each other? Or, I mean, as writers,
talk about it. I mean, when he has difficulty with his work, I'll talk to him in a general way and tell him what I went through with mine, and vice versa. Yeah. There's times when he got really discouraged on this book he published last year.
Almighty Me.
Yeah. And I kept telling him, well, you know, it's just par for the course. It's the third novel. It's hard. It's the hardest one. And he just, you know, I wrote 4 manuscripts between my second and third novels. And that kind of thing, just, yeah. You know. But generally, we're really just, you know, how do you feel? Good. Yeah, me too. I feel okay, too. I guess we're both all right then, yeah. So.
Now, you're working on another novel, is that right?
Mm-hmm. It's called Rebel Powers. I really like it a lot. It's a first-person novel. Somebody's telling it all the way through.
Uh-huh.
An event that happened 20 years ago and that I made up.
Uh-huh.
It's fun. But you know, I'm about halfway finished.
Yeah. Well, I realize it's probably not even... I don't know if you're a guy who believes in bad luck or good luck, but I don't know. Most writers don't like to talk about what they're involved in.
Oh, I know, but I think that's kind of precious. I don't mind talking about it. I've told people, I remember at the end of The Man Who Knew Bell Star, I was in a restaurant with a friend saying, I've got her at the edge of this road saying, did I get you? McCrae, did I get you? And I was having so much fun. I was telling him the end of the story, and I didn't even know it yet.
Oh, yeah.
If you just relaxed about it and it's sort of, if you trust your subconscious and you don't think about it, it's not intellectual, it's a thing you just do, then it's really hard to mess yourself up, you know. You have to be pretty dumb to mess yourself up that way. And if you separate it out, I mean, Hemingway would stop and then read Dumb Magazine. Mary Lee Settle, who's a wonderful writer, between books she reads, you know, mysteries. She's the one who taught me that. I was trying to write Take Me Back and I was all wound up like a... You know, I kept saying, I don't understand. And she said, oh, Richard, you just got to get stupid. Just look at a lot of dumb TV and read a lot of mystery stories and relax. Let the urn fill up, she said.
That's novelist Richard Bausch. His latest book is called Violence. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is in New Hampshire for tomorrow's primary and joins us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. New Hampshire does vote tomorrow. It's a beautiful, warm day here, kind of a holiday atmosphere all day as the candidates have gone around trying to gather up the last possible undecided voter. We've sent our reporters along with them, and we'll be talking to them to see what they've found. We also will be talking to other people around the country about what the New Hampshire primary looks like from a distance. And today we're going to concentrate on the middle-class voter the candidates are talking to, because here in New Hampshire, there are people who are finding their grip on the middle class is not as good as they thought it was.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Forget about the outrageous stories in the tabloids. Book critic John Leonard says he's been reading about a much more gripping scandal in the new book, The Dead Sea Scrolls Deception, why a handful of religious scholars conspired to suppress the revolutionary contents of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here's his review.
In case you've wondered what the fuss is really all about, the Dead Sea Scrolls deception is a wonderfully lively introduction to the clannish world of scholarship and ideology. I'll admit here that all I know about the scrolls discovered in the Qumran caves near Jerusalem in 1947 is what I read in Edmund Wilson and the newspapers. I'm not competent to pronounce upon the many provocations and luridities of these British reporters who wrote a highly regarded previous book about the search for the historical Jesus, except to say that as rough as Oliver Stone was on the Warren Commission, Bagent and Lee are rougher on the coterie of Roman Catholic scholars who have refused to publish photos, much less translations, of the complete scrolls for more than 40 years. Whether the coterie's paranoia has confabulated a matching paranoia of investigative journalism, I can't tell you. But the pen portraits here of these scholars and their many academic enemies, of the bureaucrats who were supposed to keep an eye on them in Jordan and Israel, and of the clerics in the Vatican with a vested interest in keeping the Gospels safe from revisionism, are a wonder of savage detail, as if we'd wandered into a novel by Evelyn Waugh. And the reading of the evidence, archaeological, anthropological, historical, and analytic textual, is ingenious and persuasive, up to the point of my own manifest limitations. Besides, I love a scandal. We are told, among many other assertions, that the coterie has suppressed texts that might embarrass the Vatican, that it's done its best to ruin the careers of independent scholars who have challenged its working methods and its interpretations, and that at least two of its members are on record as anti-Semites. Leaning heavily on the scholarship of Robert Eisenman at California State University, Bagent and Lee argued that the scrolls belonged to the 1st century A.D. instead of the pre-Christian era, that the authors and custodians of the scrolls weren't the sexless and pacifistic Essenes previously advertised, but rather the bloodthirsty zealots who died at Masada, that in fact Essenes and zealots weren't separate sects at all, but more or less nicknames for different tendencies in one big Jewish nationalistic and messianic movement determined to overthrow the Roman occupation of Palestine. We are also told, most provocatively, that Paul himself may have been an informer or an agent of the Romans, promoting a new religion to subvert this revolutionary nationalism. Well, is that enough scandal for you? Perhaps the Dead Sea coterie has been just careerist greedy, and maybe incompetent, and certainly wrong-headed, but I don't know about dishonest or sinister. Think of this review as gossip. I'm only telling you what I heard this book say. But wow, talk about Clinton's sex life. Anyway, and how you feel about this depends on how you feel about history and historians, the facts won't change anybody's faith. No matter what science tells us, we go on believing in mysteries and miracles. We need them more than we need bad news.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed the Dead Sea Scrolls deception, why a handful of religious scholars conspired to suppress the revolutionary contents of the Dead Sea Scrolls, by Michael Bagent and Richard Lee, published by Summit Books. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Ron Barron. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's tough to be a professional athlete. It's even tougher to be a woman athlete, making it in the man's world of pro basketball. On the next edition of Fresh Air, Nancy Lieberman tells us about her career in pro basketball and about her relationship with tennis star Martina Navratilova. Also, how to eat healthy when you're eating fast food. That and more on the next Fresh Air.